Hello, people of the world. My name is Jeff Allen Wang, and you are listening to the Grok This Podcast. Welcome back to the Grok This Podcast. I know I have been on a roughly 4-month hiatus after my latest episode, episode 11, which I talked about abortion and the economics of abortion. But yeah, over the summer, I felt like I didn't really have the time. And honestly, I just felt like I wanted to take a break after I did roughly 10 weeks weekly episodes, which was my original goal for the year of 2019. But I want to amp it back up and continually, persistently do more podcast episodes and discuss things and important topics about society that I find interesting and hopefully other people find interesting. So thank you for listening. Before I discuss today's topic is going to be about kind of economics and the bridge of happiness with labor and kind of work life and society in general, with a little bit of philosophy that I've been learning in school. So stay tuned for that. I'm going to discuss those things really shortly after I do a quick recap of basically what's been going on in my life for those who care to hear. So over the summer, I was fortunate enough to get to spend a week in Tokyo, Japan, and then also spend a week in Seoul, Korea, South Korea afterwards. Going to Japan was kind of a long-awaited plan that I was supposed to go after I graduated high school, but unfortunately my health kind of deteriorated around that time, so I had to cancel the trip. So my sister went alone without me, but this time I finally got to go back to Japan and Korea this time with my sister and kind of do an Asia tour. I got to eat lots of good food, sushi, ramen, and also spend some time in Korea. I got to eat lots of good food in Korea, and we went to Disney and amusement parks in Tokyo and Korea. So after Japan and Korea, I flew to Hong Kong, where I studied abroad for 7 weeks. I studied Chinese economics and also did an internship at a financial advisory company called Convoy Global Holdings. And if anyone of you have been keeping up with the news and political unrest recently that's been occurring in Hong Kong, you might know how kind of an exciting time it was for me to be in Hong Kong during the summer of 2019. I kind of saw the very beginning of the political unrest up until rising up near the peak, where what I thought was the peak, but it's just continually trending upwards in terms of the political unrest. I'm still staying tuned a lot with what's happening in Hong Kong. I did have the fortunate time to study the history and economics of Hong Kong and all the things that's been happening because of the China extradition bill and how the Hong Kong people are protesting and basically fighting for their freedom away from China's kind of authoritarian political oversight. But I do plan on eventually doing a podcast about Hong Kong and the current situation, but it takes quite a while for me to kind of formulate a certain opinion on exactly what's happening. And you know, every day something new happens, so it's very, very difficult to kind of keep up with all the things that's been happening there. But it was a very exciting time for me in that respect, but as I continue to watch the foldings of what happens. So that was basically a quick recap of the past few months for me. Right now I am a junior at Villanova University. Very excitingly for me, I am studying in the business school and economics, but I've also decided to pick up a double major in philosophy in the College of Liberal Arts. So kind of I'm trying to contrast business and philosophy, or basically economics and happiness. How do I build bridges between having money, but also having money and being happy in that sense. So that's kind of something I want to talk about today. So stay tuned for my discussion on labor and economics and happiness. But first, a quick word from my sponsors. So in the classes I've been taking right now at Villanova, I'm taking 3 philosophy-based classes, very exciting classes, as well as 2 economics classes and a computer science coding class. But the 3 philosophy classes I'm taking, one of them is called Development of Capitalism. The other one is called Philosophy of Exchange, which discusses kind of debt and capital and how we exchange in society. transactions. And the third class is an independent study that I've been doing with the chair of the philosophy department, and we've been discussing Rousseau recently. And all the three topics I've been studying right now kind of tie in together in terms of labor and how we constitute a society in terms of civil societies and how we contribute societies. Labor and acquire things and goods and transactions. So I kind of want to discuss kind of the general overview that economists have is that markets, free markets, is generally a good thing. Why? Because when we have free markets, there's generally an invisible hand, as Adam Smith contributed, which is the invisible hand pushes markets and companies and corporations and individuals to satisfy the economics demands and supply in a certain society. And we've kind of looked at historically, we see things like communism and or even the far fascist or dictatorship, too much government oversight. There's generally been a economic standstill or kind of regression, just because it's very difficult for the government to kind of satisfy every individual's needs in terms of central planning. In economies, when we kind of draw these out in models, we refer to this as the overall economic welfare, which is the overall economic benefit that a certain economy has when they are allowed to exchange amongst themselves and trade goods and services. And what we see in those models is that when we add taxes, government taxes, or when we add import taxes or kind of price control, we reduce the overall economic welfare of the model, because certain people who would like to exchange with other people and have free markets, they're unable to due to certain taxes or kind of subsidies that the government is contributing to the economy. So generally, the overview of economists is that we prefer free markets. Now, that doesn't necessarily say we are super pro-capitalism and anti-government intervention, but it is kind of opens up the discussion of how we can have free markets and government planning in terms of building a good country. So one of the few industries that we do need central government planning is things that have externalities, which is kind of things that don't necessarily directly affect the people that contribute to that kind of industry. So a great example is a pollution externality. So the companies that do the most polluting and make the most profit off that, they have the externality of pollution, which affects the other individuals in the world. And because they are profiting, the externality of pollution doesn't directly affect them, but it also directly affects other people. So externalities need to kind of be controlled in terms of government planning. Another example is national security, because if national security were not government planned and we had private corporations that had national security, let's say America had national security and they needed $100 million to fund their national security. And what the general population might realize is that once the $100 million is funded, the other people, maybe only 50% of the people need to pay for that national security. The other 50% don't end up paying. And what happens is, what happens if a country attacks America? Well, the national security is still going to defend America and protect the country, regardless of the other 50% of the population not paying for national security. So they're realizing that they can benefit and kind of, you know, it's called the free rider effect, which free rides on terms of other people's expenses. So national security is definitely something that is very beneficial for government planning. We also look at infrastructure or kind of roads and bridges. Those things generally need government planning. But going on that sense, so we talk about free markets and a little bit of government planning, and we want to discuss how in the economy, how do we justify then with free markets, how do we justify having richer people, more wealthy people, and people who are less wealthy? How do we justify this system, and how do we counteract someone who might be pro-socialist and pro-Marxist who believes more in full equality? So the Defense in that is we want to discuss how free markets offers a justice system in terms of acquisition of goods and acquisition of one person's wealth in a free market system. So in free markets, we generally want to say that there's more opportunity for people to kind of earn what they deserve. Now, regardless of what political standpoint you are, you generally kind of see that there's a good amount of opportunity. Whether or not that opportunity is equal is what we want to discuss here, whether that opportunity is equal for all individuals, regardless of race, gender, and national origin. So that's the kind of hot debate here we have in terms of free markets. So let me discuss kind of a theory that I've kind of seen in Locke and Rousseau, kind of two political philosophers that I've been studying recently. Their theory is that the only thing that we really own is our own labor. Let me repeat that again. So the only thing we really own is our own labor. And because we own our own labor, what we do in an economy is we trade our time and labor for goods and services, and then thus we can then own those things. So if I trade in my labor and do work and receive money, I can then use that money to purchase a home, and now that home is mine in terms of ownership. So everything needs to be kind of looked at in terms of labor in the economy. But whether or not that means everyone was able to acquire goods and services in a justified way, we need to look back historically, and we see that even though a lot of people do a lot of hard work in modern society, historically we see that the wealthy are the ones that kind of realized if they can leverage the labor of other people in society, they can then become more wealthy through the division of labor and kind of leveraging essentially slavery. So you look at America's kind of foundation, and it was built on first the kind of unjust acquisition of native Aboriginal people's land, and then the foundation of building America through leveraging African Americans' labor and through slavery. So that's kind of the major counter argument in terms of modern society. So generally in free markets, you might ask someone, if Bill Gates is a justly acquired wealthy person, did he personally acquire his wealth in a just manner? And a lot of people would say yes, because he didn't infringe on other people's liberty, which is one of the major things, is you to acquire goods and services in a just manner, you cannot infringe on other people's liberty. And by so far as we know, Bill Gates did not hold a gun up to wealthy people and steal their money. And another way is that he did work really hard. Bill Gates was very smart and wise. He went to Harvard and then dropped out of Harvard because Harvard couldn't teach him anything. And then he sold software, Microsoft software, and he didn't do it in a oppressive way. It's not like, again, he did not hold up a gun to people forcing us to buy his software. We enacted on our own freedom and purchased Microsoft products. So a lot of aspects, yes, Bill Gates' wealth was justly acquired. But again, when we look back historically, there is an asterisk, because the original acquisition of America and America's wealth was not just. That original acquisition, that first acquisition of wealth by generally European white males through the leveraging of slavery and the unjust acquisition of Aboriginal Native American land, that has a huge asterisk on that aspect, because there's a big argument that that was not a just acquisition of personal labor. So when we look at that standpoint, we need to go and look at how modern society can fix that. How can we kind of right the wrong that we've done in the past? And a lot of that is seen in kind of equality initiatives, where we try to contribute back to African Americans and also Native Americans and also other minorities, and try to lift them up the line and kind of put them back up in terms of equal opportunity. So you see a lot of that in terms of jobs and companies trying to do diversity initiatives, which I think is great because it is kind of addressing one of the major issues, historical issues, and trying to kind of right the wrong in the sense that of our past ancestors or past American ancestors. So now I want to go back even further in history and discuss kind of what Rousseau considers the origin of inequality, one of his books, The Origin of Inequality, and kind of the history in that terms of how we came to this civilization where we have all these big gaps in terms of society and wealth and inequalities in life. So if you look back and go back to history, during the hunter-gatherer society era, you see who was the most economically beneficial, who was the strongest, wealthiest person in that time. And generally, you see that it's the person who is born physically strongest through genetically or potentially genetically and a contribution of physical training. And that strongest person is generally going to be a male. And then you kind of see that the development of sexism was almost natural in that sense. Because the strongest male, doesn't matter how clever or wise you are in terms of inventing traps and catching 100 rabbits, because the strongest male in the tribe can come up to you and steal all your rabbits or beat you up. And also the strongest male will also be able to dominate other individuals and get to court the choice of their female and also kind of control the tribe. And through that, a natural process of the physical person, brawn beating brain, you saw that males developed this inequality of physical strength and the natural innate desire for humanity to retain power. So we saw that males began to oppress women and kind of retain this power. And through, you know, centuries of this evolution, we saw how even despite modern society where physical strength is not equal necessarily economic benefit or wealth necessarily in modern society, because people are able to leverage information and technology and other attributes besides just physical strength, even to today we see that through, you know, hundreds, thousands of years of oppression for male over female, that we still see signs of that. That's kind of the natural origin of inequality in terms of male and females, which now we realize it doesn't really make sense that we still have that, because during the hunter-gatherer society it did make a little sense that the male would have greater wealth naturally because of that society in that time era. But now it just doesn't make sense, and because modern society does not leverage these same attributes. So what Rousseau considers that is that we had a physical inequality, which is the male being stronger than the female, now transition from that physical inequality into moral inequality. And the reason that happened was because we attributed too much importance on the physical inequality, and then we created this huge gap in terms of civil society. So he has this kind of story of a bunch of people gathering around a tree and a person singing under the tree, singing very beautifully. And then the people gathering around, they attributed a lot of value to that person's singing, his physical voice. And then seeing that this person's singing, they start comparing themselves and seeing that they want to be equally good and strive to become just as good than the singer. And this comparison is the kind of the origin, one of the origins of building this inequality in civil society, because this comparison builds this wantingness of perfectibility in humanity. And he says this perfectibility is what makes us different from animals. Humans want to strive to become greater in a sense and become perfect. And comparing ourselves to other humans is how we do that. But through this comparison, we start building this natural inequality and this gross kind of gap in terms of who is ranked higher or lower in this civil society. And through this kind of building comparison is how we got to this point. And it's kind of something he wants to destroy he says that Savage Man, he refers to Savage Man more as natural, like a natural man, not in an offensive way. Of course, during his era of writing, Savage Man had less of a negative connotation, but he says the Savage Man is the person who is satisfied and okay with natural habitats and does not work himself to death, while Civil Man, or modern society, the people that we've become, is striving for a wantingness of perfectibility, and we end up working ourselves to death. I'm going to read a good, really lovely quote that I love from his book, The Origin of Inequality, here. So Jean-Jacques Rousseau writes in The Origin of Equality, quote, "What reflection teaches us on this subject is perfectly confirmed by observation. Savage man and civilized man differ so greatly in the depths of their hearts and in their inclinations that what constitutes the supreme happiness of the one will reduce the other to despair. Savage man breathes only tranquility and liberty. He wants simply to live and rest easy, and not even the unperturbed tranquility of the Stoic approaches his profound indifference for any other objects. On the other hand, the citizen is always active and in a sweat, always agitated and unceasingly tormenting himself in order to seek still more laborious occupations. Civil man works until he dies. He even runs to his death in order to be in a position to live, or renounces life in order to acquire immortality." End quote. That's a very beautiful line, that ending line where he says civil man is a person who renounces his own life in order to attempt to acquire immortality. And we see that a lot in modern society, I think. I see that in a lot where, you know, the general theory is that if you talk to someone on the deathbed, they'll always say that they regret working too much and not spending more time with their family and loved ones. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau is writing this hundreds of years ago, and he kind of foresaw that in terms of the French Revolution, France era, and he sees that in the future as well, as we still continue to have battles in terms of labor and economics, and contrasting that with happiness. So the comparison is, we want to see how can we balance our needs and wants. So one big economic assumption that a lot of people make is that we need to make decisions. We need to study economics because we live in a world where there is scarce goods, as in there's not enough goods and services for everyone, but we also have unlimited wants and desires. So how do we attribute and kind of consolidate our time and energy so we can satisfy our unlimited wants with the scarce goods in this world? Of course, the earth is only limited in its resources. But again, you, under that assumption, you realize that it's kind of a paradoxical assumption. If we have unlimited desires and wants, we'll never be satisfied. So what Rousseau says, the savage man, he says, is perfectly tranquil. Savage man breathes only tranquility and liberty. He wants simply to live and rest easy and be in a kind of satisfied state. So if we kind of balance our needs and wants in a more in a more observational way, we might be able to satisfy more of our life and realize we don't need to have unlimited desires, we don't need unlimited wants. Sometimes it's okay to have enough. And it reminds me of a story. I don't remember the particular details, but there was a bunch of wealthy people and prestigious people at a party, and one of the characters, he goes up to his friend and he says, "Hey, look at that person over there, you know, look at how many accomplishments he has, how much wealth he has, how much prestige he has. Doesn't that make you feel bad, because you don't have, although you have a lot of prestige yourself, you don't have as much as that person over there. What do you have?" And then the main character responds, "I have enough." And that's a kind of a story that's always struck with me, because we're so easily comparing ourselves, both physical inequalities that's turned into this moral inequality. We put so much emphasis on certain things in terms of beauty and physical attraction, physical looks, height, skin color, hair, race, wealth, job, positions, education. We put so much emphasis on these physical traits that we've built this moral inequality in ourselves that one person who is more beautiful is somehow greater than the person who is subjectively less beautiful. Of course, it's all arbitrary because of how subjective it is. But when we have this moral inequality and this kind of comparison and wantingness of perfectibility, that's how we build unsatisfaction. That's how we factor in unsatisfaction into our lives. So it's good to strive for things. Don't get me wrong. I always believe that, you know, I never say I'm perfect because I'm not perfect, but I have a wantingness of perfectibility, which keeps me humble and keeps me striving for greatness. But on the other hand, I need to make sure that I'm balancing my striving for greatness with a tranquil acceptance of enough. Because if I only strive, then I will always be striving for the rest of my life. Because at some point, you have to really see that no amount of money can buy the tranquility that having enough in life offers. So that's the end of that podcast episode. I'm very glad that I'm getting back into this because it is something I want to be more persistent with. Thank you for all my listeners, to all five of you, for listening this far. If you end up getting this far, I really appreciate it. Thank you for trying to learn more about the world, trying to grok the world a little bit more, and going on this journey with me. Hopefully, I get to produce more of these episodes, and hopefully, you are also enjoying them and learning a little bit alongside with me. Thank you.